Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to our podcast. Hello, Mark. Are you there?
Mona, I am here. So glad to be back. So glad to share more of this EB5 information with everybody. How you doing?
I'm very well. Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us. And we also have Rebecca.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Rebecca. Okay, Mona, so since we have you here and we have Rebecca here, we must have a pretty good topic. So what are we talking about today?
Well, today we're talking about the entrepreneur visa. There's a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings about it, so we want to clarify a few very important issues.
Especially that the entrepreneur visa is becoming more popular now. So we're seeing more and more standalone, which is another word for the entrepreneur visas, that are being filed with USCIS.
And Mark, I do believe that you've already had a podcast on this before, and you've got a lot of questions on entrepreneur visas, right?
Oh, I still get questions to this day. And in fact, Mona, I had you on my podcast about 2 years ago.
Yeah, that was a while.
Yeah, it was a while. We covered a lot of ground, and I still get questions and feedback to this day. So yeah, people still have questions. So hopefully we can clear that up during this episode.
Right, right. We actually have found that we've got more and more inquiries as well as actual cases on entrepreneur visas. So we want to clarify a number of issues. So really, let's get started.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think we wanted to explain for anybody listening in what an entrepreneur visa is as opposed to a project from what's called direct pooled or a regional center, because people really don't understand. Everything gets clubbed in with the name EB5. But very basically, the difference between an entrepreneur visa is when it's your visa, when it's your project.
Correct. What's funny is when Congress came out with the EB-5 program, it actually started with the entrepreneur visas. So this started back in 1990, and eventually what we know now as the Regional Center Pilot Program, that caught on later.
Well, that was actually introduced, quick background here, that was actually introduced in the 90s, but it didn't really... there was a lot of problems with it. It didn't really take off. And it's only this year, I would say 2004, 2005 onwards, that the regional center program as we know it today has emerged. Then there was this period of time when entrepreneur visas were very unpopular. And then suddenly over the last 3 or 4 years, they've sprouted up. And recently, again, they're really back at the forefront. It's very hot again right now.
Mm-hmm.
There is another type of direct visa called direct pooled. People, again, get confused. There are three different types of EB-5 projects where you can get your visa from. One is a regional center project, one is a direct pool project, and the third is the entrepreneur. The direct pooled and the regional center project are probably are the most similar in the sense that they are both passive. And there are the basic similarity between the two is that the investor goes into that project and they don't really do anything except for perhaps policy formation. The main difference between a regional center project and a direct pool project is the job creation, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. That's differentiated from the third type, which is the entrepreneur visa, which is a standalone visa, a standalone project, and usually has maybe one or two or three people, but is not pooled.
So if they're not pooled and it's not a passive investment, it's an active investment, what are some of the typical business structures? Is it an equity thing that you typically see for entrepreneurs in EB-5?
Oh, yeah. We actually have quite a lot. I mean, over the last few years, especially the time that it started taking for regional centers to go to put together, we did a lot of direct pooled cases. And we've done a lot of entrepreneur. Now, I'm going to give you a bit of reasoning as well, why so much has jumped up. But Rebecca, we should name a few of the types of entrepreneur cases, not direct pooled.
Yeah. So what's popular, what we've seen for direct entrepreneur cases have been, for instance, franchises. For instance, recently, we just did one with a Popeyes franchise, McDonald's. You even have other franchises, Pizza Hut, things of that nature. So those have become popular. That depends on the area, though. I think the area locations for these projects are very important.
Right. With franchises, there's two types that we have seen in the market. Basically, one is when somebody's coming in and just doing it totally themselves, which is very tough, I have to tell you. We'll talk about that in a second. And the second is if they come in and do a franchise with a third party who actually own the franchise. And interestingly, franchises isn't just limited to food. We've seen franchises in not just restaurants, but in hairdressers, even in cars. Yeah. You know, so
transportation industry.
Right, right. So there's a lot of areas where the franchise is actually coming in. And in addition, there's a lot of people who are in this country on an E2 visa. They put money in their own business. And then from there, they've sort of progressed to filing for an EB5.
Yeah, in addition to that, Mark, we have a lot of clients here who are on H1B or L visas who are also looking into this opportunity because it's easy. They're here in the U.S. They can see the project. They see what it's like. They've been here for a few years. They can see that what projects are viable for an entrepreneur visa.
Well, let me ask you a question that's probably on our listeners' mind right now. When they hear a possible conversion from like an E2 or an H1B into an EB5, can they use the funds that they've generated here in America through their E2 enterprise, or does it have to come from offshore for EB5?
No, it depends. No, they would be the money that they invested into the E2. But if, for example, if I gave you an example that somebody invested into an E2 business 10 years ago and they invested maybe 200,000 and now that business has generated them income of another 600,000, can they count it as 800,000? No, it's got to be new capital coming in. Investment.
I'm glad you cleared that up.
Right.
Yeah, it's also important to note that the H1 and the L's are not necessarily going to convert into an EB5 as well. So when I mean H1s or L visas, they're here in the U.S. It's just that they see that the entrepreneur visas is more viable to them and to get started with that visa. So it's not necessarily means they're going to convert it into an EB5.
Right, right.
Right. It actually can't be converted because E's and L's, those are non-immigrant visas, and that's a different track. EB5 is an immigrant visa, a different track. If you can imagine a railway track with two rails going simultaneously together, parallel together, that they never cross. The money itself does not need to totally come offshore. It just needs to be invested. And I mean, if you, for example, have that money within the United States and it's your money and you want to invest into a project, but the money itself does not need to come offshore per se.
Yeah, you can earn the funds in the U.S. as long as you've earned it legally and it's retained earnings and it's not the company's money. So there's a difference between using money that's earned by the company, that's retained with the company, versus the money that you've earned from a salary or dividends or bonuses. So the company is its own entity. So we have to remember that.
That makes sense. Yeah, because the company is an American company and those retained earnings couldn't be used for an EB5. But if the company owner either took a dividend or salary and it became the ownership of that foreign national that's on a non-resident visa, then it is seen as an investment into the U.S.
Right. That's correct. We actually had a problem sent to me from, because we do often do co-counseling with other lawyers, and somebody sent me a case whereby their particular client was using projected earnings, and then that was denied. And you cannot do that. You cannot do projected earnings. It has to be actual earnings.
Okay. Right. Well, let's talk, the million-dollar question. Right. How much money do they need to invest?
All right. It's funny, but often I've heard this, and I've heard this from lawyers, too. And they call entrepreneur visas the $1 million visa, which is wrong. No, the entrepreneur visa itself is not a $1 million visa. What decides whether a petition should be filed at the 500 level or the $1 million level is whether or not the project is within a TEA.
And by TEA, you mean targeted employment area?
I do. So it could be anywhere. That said, most entrepreneur visas are not $500 visas, and that's because of a practical reason. At $500,000, if you have $500,000, it's very, very difficult to show the viability of a project, which you have to also have 10 full-time employees, even if you count them at minimum wage, and be able to sustain that business over a period of time. So for the very fact that it's not practical, but that doesn't mean to say you have to show the 500 or you have to show a million. But it's more likely than not that you will end up spending a lot more than 500.
Correct. And a lot of the popular projects that we have seen with the entrepreneur visas were these franchises because of the viability. You don't need as much as you would need, for instance, in a hotel. You know, an entrepreneur is not going to go in and invest into a hotel, especially in New York City, because you need way more than $500,000.
Yeah. And then we get projects, we get clients who come up to us and say, show us, for example, a Baskin Robbins, which can be very efficiently operated with two people. And they want to use that as EB-5. And then we really caution them and say, look, this is operational, this is profitable because there's two people. If you have to now put 10 full-time people, first of all, can you justify it to USCIS? And secondly, it's going to eat into your profits. One example of a project that we assisted on was a dentist office. It was a single dentist up in Boston. This dentist wanted 6 assistants. He really could not justify 6 assistants. He could justify maybe 2, but not more than that. And so USCIS had given them an RFE, and quite frankly, there really wasn't a response you could do, or you could handle on that. But if he actually, I often asked him, I said, if you're going to have 6 dental assistants, how much are you paying out? Is this really going to be viable at the end of the day?
So as you can see, Mark, these visas, the entrepreneur visas, are much more difficult putting together than your typical pool direct or your regional center projects, just because you can do more with pooled money rather than just a single $500,000.
Right. And I think also it's very important for people to understand that you are not putting in a project just for your visa only. At the end of the day, you have a business. You've got to run this business. This business takes over. And for that reason, the corporate structure has to be really finely tuned. We have seen a lot of cases where there's a mess with the corporate structure. Even if you get through USCIS, there are complications later down the road because nobody's thought out beyond the fact that this is for immigration. And they've not thought out that, okay, on a practical level, how are we actually going to divide money when we get become profitable 5 years down the road? So there's been litigation and all kinds of problems.
Let me ask you this. If they invest the bare minimum to get it off the ground, and even in their own plan, their own projections, they're saying, look, this is the bare minimum. I'm really requiring profitability in, say, you know, like 9 to 12 months in order to get cumulative cash flows to grow the business to sustain the 10 plus jobs that I need. Would USCIS, would they approve the 526? We'll say, go for it. We'll see you when you try to remove conditions. Or will they just give you an RFE and say, no, you need to have all the money up front to sustain the business?
Well, no, they don't want all the money up front in the sense that you are able to what's called actively invest and put money in slowly. However, everything has to be very well detailed.
Okay.
And that's where your business plan and your documents come in. You can have it all in your head, but if your documents don't show it and USCIS don't see it, it won't get through. In fact, we've seen a bunch of denials on very good cases. Mm-hmm. It's just the fact the documentation wasn't correct. They just could not articulate where the money or how the where the money was coming from or how the business would be viable. And if USCIS does not see the business as viable, they don't see it as credible. And one of the primary factors for your business plan getting through under Matter of Ho is that your project is credible.
Exactly. And Mark, what we like to do here at Monashand Associates, we like to advise our clients first that it's important to show that it's a business that is viable. And then a lot of people are coming here on the entrepreneur visa because they want to make this their living. So we tell them and advise them first before looking at the EB-5 program. And we will work with them to make sure that it adapts to the EB-5 regulations, but to make sure that in itself that it is worthwhile to go into a business and that it will make money in the end. And that instead of, as Mona was mentioning earlier, instead of trying to hire 10 direct employees, is it worthwhile for you to hire 10 direct employees rather than having 2? So I think it's important for our listeners out there to know that it's a business first.
Right.
Right. I really want to stress that because so many immigration lawyers don't get advice on the business aspect. Again, it is a business first. Primarily, it's a business. You have to make money out of this as well as get your green card. Many times we've advised our client away from entrepreneur. They come to us and they have all these high-flying ideas and we get practical with them. I mentioned earlier that franchises, for example, were difficult. If you come in as an overseas person, for example, and you want to put up a Burger King, first of all, you have to qualify for a franchise. And for qualifying for a franchise is not so easy. And there's all of these rules and regulations. Secondly, where are you going to locate your business? Not to have any idea of the locality can really destroy. You can have a fantastic business, which would be so profitable if it was on a certain street, and yet that same business would not be profitable if it was on a street behind, when hidden or something. So location can be so important. And then there are other nuances involved. So when somebody from overseas comes over and says, look, I just want to invest in my own business, I want to open my own business, our first way forward is to gauge how much experience that person has, how much knowledge that person has of the US market or the locality that they want to go into, and how much knowledge they have from business, the business side, which is usually very little. And then we gear them away if we can and say, look, go into a passive investment initially, get in the country, and then once you get your money back, or if you have other funds, put it into your own business, and perhaps you can make a more profitable model by having less employees and when there's no pressure of EB-5. And often that really does work well.
Okay. No, I appreciate that. So let's transition a little bit and let's talk about some types of markets for these investors, say like, you know, India versus China, and, you know, really what some of these investors may be looking for in an entrepreneur visa.
Right. Well, actually, I wanted to actually start with China because I think we have a lot more to say about India as well. And I wanted to introduce another attorney from our firm. This is Hui Zheng.
Hi, Mark. Nice to meet you.
Yeah. Hi, Hui. Good to meet you as well. So let's talk about the China market.
So from my experience, most of the Chinese investors, they prefer to invest into a regional center affiliated project rather than an entrepreneur project. So I think the following may be the primary reason. First is a language barrier. As you know, most of the Chinese investors, they don't speak English and they don't have much knowledge of the business culture and the business law of the U.S. So for them, EB-5 is just a way to get their green card. And most of them, based on my conversation with them, they are very conservative. So they say, I would rather do my business in China. So that is one of the things. And also,
have seen a bunch of Chinese investors coming into franchise where they don't have to do anything.
Oh, yes.
Or direct pooled projects.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And in that case, they would use something like a management team from the franchise or a third-party management team to really help them out?
Yes.
But they don't want to get involved themselves in a way that other cultures do want to get involved.
Yes, agree. And I also think another reason is a tax concern. As we know, U.S. has a very mature tax system. However, on the opposite, it is a well-known secret that Chinese companies and high-net-income individuals, they keep substantial income in their off-book record. So they understand if they do business in the U.S., unlike what they do in China, they have to file taxes every year based on their actual income. So due to the high tax concern, they say, I don't want to do business in the U.S. So that is another reason.
Right. And I think that one other reason also is, Hui, is that a lot of Chinese who come in don't really want to live here in the way other markets do. They're right. Doing it primarily for the children.
Yes. So that comes to my third reason is because of lack of management ability. So due to the visa retrogression, we see many international students become the primary investors. So their purpose, they are at the age of 15 to 20. So their primary purpose in the U.S. is for their study. They are under the F1 visa. So they prefer to invest into a regional center affiliated project so they don't need to worry about any management.
Right. And also with you touched on visa retrogression, Hui. Mm. Visa retrogression basically means is that there will be a delay on it before somebody can actually get into the United States. Mm. And if they have an entrepreneur type of project, they have to be here. Because one of the big things about entrepreneur cases is that you have to manage it. You don't have the freedom of living in one state and having a project in another state. You have to work within that.
Yes. Greg, yeah.
Okay, so the learning here really is that although a lot of EB-5 investors are coming from mainland China, most of those investors from mainland China probably would not be looking towards an entrepreneur visa.
Right, unless it was something which was managed by someone else or their involvement was more passive. It's not that they don't go into direct visas. They do direct cases. They just don't come and work here in the same manner and they don't have that same kind of hands-on type of experience that other cultures do.
Okay. Are there any EB-5 investor markets that would probably gravitate more towards an entrepreneur visa?
Yes. Yes, there are. One of the markets is the Latin American market. We've seen most people who want to come in from countries like Brazil or Venezuela or Mexico, they are coming here to live and to stay. And so they want to do an entrepreneur visa, mainly because, you know, these guys are not necessarily overly rich, and they may have $500,000 or a little more, but they don't have an excessive of extra amount of extra money. So what they want to do is they want to have a business whereby they can also create some kind of income to live on. And that we see a lot from Latin America. We see that also from some parts of Europe. And we definitely see a lot of that from India.
Okay. Let's explore the India market a little bit.
So, Mark, I'm going to chip in here for a bit. Yes, we have seen the standalone or the entrepreneur visas expand widely in the India market. But there are two tiers. We see the same as the China market, where they're doing it for their children. They want to make sure their children come here and get the education and not necessarily want to live here permanently. But we have the second group who are here because they want to come here and they want to make a living in the U.S. So these visas are becoming popular in that category.
Yeah, and again, the main thing is, which is something that Hui brought up, which was the language barrier and the business culture. Indians are used to speaking in English. English is very much, it's not even a second language for most people. It's very much a first language. Thanks to the British Raj and et cetera. but and the business culture is there because many of them have dealt with, they have businesses in Dubai, they deal with London, they deal with the United States in one form or the other. So there is an understanding. And I think that is there a little more than the Chinese.
We've really covered two broad ends of the spectrum, the Chinese market that may not be looking towards the entrepreneur visas heavily, Latin America, which may the investors there may lend themselves more, whether it's through, language or really the understanding of the Americas market, whether it's North America, South America. And then we've also talked about India and how they may be more inclined to the entrepreneur visa because, well, they're used to doing business with English speaking people or English speaking countries. Is that a pretty good synopsis?
Yes, it certainly is, Mark.
Okay, so we've covered a lot about the different types of EB-5, and really we're focusing on the entrepreneur visa. And since it's so different, I realize that the risks involved are also different. So let's explore that a bit.
Yes, interestingly, there's a lot of denials with entrepreneur visas rather than in comparison to regional, central, or direct pooled. And one of the main reason is because the corporate structure is not correct, or also the job creation is not done correctly.
When you talk about denials, you're talking about the initial application, the 526, the initial EB-5, not so much the removal of conditions later. So we're talking about an upfront denial?
Well, actually, you see it in both sections because at the initial stage, you're making all of these forecasts and assumptions on job creation. And again, this is one of the difficulties with entrepreneur cases because it's a much smaller sort of scenario that you're looking at. And the job creation is a little bit more varied. It's not as sort of open and closed as you would have in a regional center where you would have an economic report, a certain budget, and a certain amount of minimum amount of jobs that would be created. In a entrepreneur visa, you are creating direct, full-time, permanent employees. Many times, as we mentioned just before, that business just may not be able to afford the entire amount of employees, and it ends up getting more part-time employees.
Right. Yeah, we've talked about job creation a little bit earlier in the episode, but when you mentioned corporate structure as a risk for the entrepreneur visa, what do you mean by that? I mean, what's a red flag for corporate structure on, let's say, the initial EB-5 petition, the 526? Is there a red flag for corporate structure that, would stand out and possibly make an easy denial?
Yeah, corporate structure is very, very important in either a direct pooled or a standalone like this, an entrepreneur, mainly because everybody who comes in is an equity partner. The jobs have to be created from what's called the new commercial enterprise, which is the same entity that the investor comes in. often what happens is there's a mix, and there's maybe a local partner for reasons like I have just mentioned, that you need a local partner maybe to get a franchise in, maybe to understand the localities. And then there are different corporations, or maybe you are coming in to expand somebody's business.
I see.
And if you're coming in as an investor to expand an existing business and you're coming in as an entrepreneur type of immigrant, then you have to be very careful as to where the jobs are being created, and that the money is not used in the fashion that it would in a regional center as a loan.
Yeah, so what happens here is that the new commercial enterprise, what we're going to see most often is that it's going to be the same as the job-creating entity. So the money going into the new commercial enterprise must stay in there, and the same entity must use that funds to create the 10 full-time employees. And these are direct employment.
Right. We have seen you could easily create the jobs. We've seen projects where they've created the jobs without any problem, but it's been created from the wrong entity, and therefore USCIS are not counting it.
And that's a huge denial.
Yeah. And Rebecca, also, it's very hard to fix, right?
Oh, yes. Because at that point, you have to file an application, what's called approvable upon filing. So if you have started out with the wrong corporate structure in the first place, it's hard to go back and restructure it for USCIS to accept the application, just because you're changing the entire corporate structure again. So yeah, it's not considered.
Okay.
And corporate structure is also important, Mark, in a case where, for example, somebody's coming in on a franchise, like I mentioned a little earlier, and they haven't thought beyond getting the green card. And year 4 or 5, suddenly this business is making a ton of money. And this corporate structure is such is that there isn't any organization, or there really isn't any control as to where the money's going or how it's being divided. And that has caused litigation and conflicts down the road.
So let's assume that the 526 was approved because, well, they now have expert advice from you on the corporate structure as well as, you know, forecasting the job creation in the new commercial enterprise. So now it comes time to, well, remove the green card conditions, the 829 form, I think it is. So how would you go about proving that those jobs were actually created?
Well, there, Mark, is where we have to show direct employment. So you're going to show tax records of the employees that have been working in your company. You're going to show W-2s, any other documents to prove that you've had 10 full-time direct employees.
We often recommend that an employer should use things like E-Verify as well. E-Verify is very popular with USCIS. That really how you determine how the jobs are counted are really through these very sort of basic ways. But the other thing that is very important is that we're dealing with the practical world. We're dealing with realism. And often what happens is that, yes, you have a business, you have a forecast where you're going to create 15 jobs, and you create them initially, you create the permanent jobs, but guess what? After a couple of years, you realize that, you know, you cannot sustain 15 jobs, and then you go down to maybe 8 or 9. And by the time you're filing the 829s, you really only have 8 or 9 jobs on the records. Does that mean that you don't get your 829 approved? Well, no. Once you've created the permanent job positions, that's counted. Even if you've had to let go of an employee at a later stage, as long as you can prove exactly why you had to do that and everything is verified.
Yeah. So what's important that to know is that the positions have been created. You don't necessarily need to have 10 direct employees, but you need to show that you need 10 direct positions.
Right. And USCIS did something else good this year as well. They clarified the position once and for all on the amount of time that you have to actually have a job. They brought out a jobs memo. And I've been writing about this for some time, actually, because we've been trying to answer some queries from China ever since retrogression began. That jobs do not, there's nothing there which says that the job itself has to be there for 2 years. You have 2 years in which to create the jobs, but it's the job position. And the actual policy memo clarifies that. It does not state that you have a specific amount of time that the job has to be there, just that the position has to be created.
Okay. So we've covered risk, really immigration risk, with both the initial EB-5 petition as well as the removal conditions, 18 months, 21 months, 2 years down the road. Now let's shift the conversation a little bit to another type of risk, and that's really investment risk. You know, they put their money into this entrepreneur dream, this entrepreneur vision, well, this entrepreneur visa for them. You know, what kinds of risks are involved with this, and how's that different than, say, direct pooled EB-5 or regional center EB-5?
This is much riskier, quite frankly. With a regional center or a direct pooled, somebody else is doing all the work. And you're looking and checking that person. Are they able to do it properly? How is their business plan? What's their model? What's their exit plan? Someone else is selling. If it's a condominium project, somebody else is creating the jobs. In your project, you have to specify all of this yourself. One of the biggest risks, and we advise a lot of our clients about this, is that often you will end up having to put more money in before you start getting a return. It does take 3 to 5 years on any new business before you get real profits back. So you have to be prepared for that. Again, everybody who's involved with an entrepreneur visa, even if you've come in to somebody else's business, you're coming as an equity partner. Even if you've really given them a loan and that's how you really want to think about it, it's still an equity.
So essentially, the risk is higher, but you own that risk because it's not a passive investment. It's an active investment. And
right,
you really control
right.
all the levers for that risk. And you don't have as much to lean on as well, you know, the direct pooled or regional centers.
That's the reasoning behind a lot of people wanting to do entrepreneurs too, actually, Mark, because of the control factor. They don't want to put their money into somebody else's hands. They want to maintain control. And I totally understand that. I mean, if it's a lot of money for a lot of people and they want to make a living and keep control.
Makes sense. With great power comes great responsibility.
But we also have come across cases where people have regretted afterwards doing an entrepreneur visa because they've had to put so much extra money in and they've realized that it's not quite what they expected it to be.
Exactly. And they could have used the funds that they used for the EB-5 visa and could have put it into a business that would have been more fitting or geared more towards their life earning.
Their own investment goals, yeah.
Right.
So that's a good point. So really, perhaps someone should separate their immigration investment from their own personal investment. Maybe make your immigration investment EB-5 if the risk and the payout if it kind of conflicts with your, you know, really immigration status and perhaps that of your children that are going to American schools, maybe it makes more sense to look at direct pools and regional centers vice entrepreneur visa, but it doesn't stop you from making entrepreneur investments. You can then come in to the U.S. and then invest just like, another resident could, right?
Well,
and then just focus on your returns and not your immigration.
Well, that's what we advocate. We prefer that. We prefer if an immigrant does that. I mean, even if they take our help to start something off. But when the pressure on an immigrant when they have their entire family here mm-hmm. and they have to have 10 jobs and they have to prove, it's tremendous. And the stress level gets high.
And the amount of work that you have to put into creating the project in the first place, if you're coming in on a direct pooled or a regional center project, the work's already done in the forefront. So you're coming into a project that's ready to go. You're ready to file your I-526. Whereas for your own project, it may take 6 to 8 months before you can even file the I-526 petition, just because we have to put the business plan together. You have to make sure that it's
EB-5. It can take 6 months just to sort out a lease.
Exactly.
And then you have issues with the lease and stuff. And then the landlord turns around at the last minute and doesn't go through, and you have to find another location. And there are all kinds of issues that happen. Mm-hmm. And the legal fees, of course, are much more in an entrepreneur case, because there is so much more to do. So you have to see also that, are you really saving that? Because in a regional center or direct pool project, you're paying money out as far as administration costs, yes. But in your own project, you're paying a lot more legal fees.
Exactly.
So, Mark, it does sound like, you know, we're advocating against entrepreneur visas. We're not, because there are some very, very good projects out there and people who should do entrepreneur visas. And we do tell people when they have their own business, look, why are you going into another project? You can easily create the 10 jobs from your own business. But when somebody from overseas comes in and it's obvious to us that they are making a huge mistake by putting their own business up, then we do tell them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's why it's important to have knowledgeable and good advocates for really their ultimate goals. Is it a return on investment, or is it immigration, or is it a mix of both? And perhaps it is a mix of both, but maybe they're not the right person for the particular enterprise they have planned for their entrepreneur visa. And it sounds like you would, well, honestly advise them.
Yes, honesty to the point of being very blunt.
There you go. Well, hopefully we've been very blunt on this episode. And thank you, Mona and Rebecca and Hui, for really outlining for us what the entrepreneur visa is all about.
Thank you. And thank you, Mark.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Or call the office at 212-233-7473. Don't worry about trying to write all those down, as it's already embedded in your podcast player of choice. The contact information and other valuable resources can be found there. Today, we've talked to both Mona and Rebecca about the entrepreneur visa. Now, I don't want you to think that this podcast is going to be just attorneys within Mona's firm. In fact, we're talking to many EB5 industry leaders. Starting with our next episode, where we'll be talking to Courtney Creedon of EB5 Investors Magazine. Make sure you don't miss it by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.